So okay, here, I'm just saying, okay, for the sake ahead. Of argument, Ray, for the sake of argument, the Pelicans and Kings are tied. And actually, the Blazers are tied as well, although they've played two more
they're
games.
Percentage, they're a percentage point ahead, but they're essentially
right,
a three-way tie.
So there's essentially a three-way tie for ninth. Why not just take those three and the Grizzlies, do two of them play seven. The Grizzlies play the Kings. The Blazers play the Pelicans. Winners play each other.
Round robin.
Winner of that game is the eighth seed.
How do you sell that? How do you sell that, though? I'm sorry to interrupt, but how do you sell that to San Antonio, which is only a half game behind Portland, New Orleans, and Sacramento?
Tough. Sometimes you miss out. I mean, you're going to have to draw the line at some point.
Well, then why don't you just say we have our eight teams? Because, I mean, essentially, the ninth place team is 3.5 games behind Memphis. Memphis is in the eight. So why not just say it's tough for everybody and not even bother with the remainder of the season?
You would have to. I think the only way to sell it to everyone is just saying the day to have qualified for the playoffs has passed. We are taking the top eight qualifiers as the standings remain on the night we canceled regular season play. And that's that. You know, proceed accordingly. I just think they would have to.
And truthfully, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say I don't have a problem with that. I was just thinking it. You know, though there at least was a playoff race going on in the Eastern Conference between teams, and to be fair, most importantly, the Pelicans, who I think if the NBA had their druthers, would obviously be a part of whatever happens going forward. I think it would be fun and not a bad idea to have a little play-in tournament, but you're probably right that to sell it to everybody. You know, then again, I don't know how badly the Spurs are trying to get it cranking again to play eight more games. So they might be fine with skipping the whole thing. I don't know.
Well, but we can't know that. And Greg Popovich, in all likelihood, is going to want to have every chance to qualify that he can get. But the idea that somehow they should do something for Zion Williamson's benefit simply reinforces the notion that there are relevant teams, but a lot more irrelevant teams. And at that point, what you're telling a bunch of owners who have spent a lot of money to have these teams, you guys don't matter. And there's already that perception across the league and in other leagues as well. I mean, Sean Payton said over the weekend that at any given time, there's no more than 11 relevant teams in the NFL. Well, if you're the owner of the Detroit Lions, other than collecting money, what are you in this for? I mean, to be told by another
billionaire, those teams change,
you
right,
don't
right?
matter.
Right. Well, particularly in the NFL, those teams change, the ones that matter.
But if you're going to have this play-in tournament in hopes of getting Zion into the tournament and Memphis out, then what you're telling Memphis is, just stop trying because we'll screw you every chance we get.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right. I mean, I don't know that I would interpret it that harshly, but you're probably right that that's not a realistic plan. Well, what about just playing playoffs? What if they can bubble up? Because then I think you're talking about, especially if you expedited it somewhat, like if you went back to five-game series in the first round, you don't have to take as much time off because everyone's in the same place. There's no travel whatsoever. You know, maybe you could get the whole thing done in a month and a half, 2 months, and maybe you can sell that to the 16 teams that are competing for a title.
It feels like the whole thing would have to be abridged. I mean, I know that they want to recoup all the money that they can, but look, you're just trying to make a dime where a dollar used to be at this point, I would think. And And lowering the number of games to get through rounds to get this in to make sure that the next year starts on time, I think that would have to be a priority.
Yeah, I agree. You're going to have to make a lot of changes. It's just like when we talked about baseball, right? Whatever, if they execute any of these plans we're hearing about, it's going to be a lot different from the last time we watched baseball. It just is. And I think the same is true of basketball, at least in as much as as the playoffs go, right? The game may be more or less the same, minus the crowd, but we're going to be watching a very different NBA playoffs than we've ever seen before.
Right.
There's
and
no
I know
question.
I know that no owner is interested in preserving the sanctity of playoff year-to-year comparisons, but to me that's important. And if you don't have that, I mean, if you're not measuring any playoff run against the standards set back in the day by the Lakers and then basically eclipsed by the Warriors going 16-1, winning 15 consecutive playoff games en route to the final championship, you know, I mean, like, if you're not measuring things against the same yardstick, to me, it doesn't have the historical context that it should. Now, having said all that, yeah, you put a basketball game on my television, I'll watch it right now. Like, I'm not going to worry about the historical context.
Right. And beyond even just that part of it, right? Because that's, I think, look, if we learn anything from the ratings of the first round of the NFL draft, it's that everyone's going to watch it if you put it on the TV.
Yeah, we'll
right?
take it.
I mean, we know that. But I think even beyond that, there's a, you know, this scenario of making the best of a terrible situation on so many levels in terms of getting as much in as you can. Yes, it will be different in historical context. Just like I think if you have a serious conversation about NBA championships, the Spurs 99 championship is different historically than others because the season was irreparably damaged by a lockout and everything was shifted around. It was a very different season than any other we've seen, really. So, yes, it will have that mark upon it, but I don't think there's no confusion here that it beats the heck out of not having anything.
Except for one thing. You are jeopardizing people's lives, at least to some extent, if you don't have a vaccine or the ability to test massively and repeatedly, not just for the players, but for everybody else who is going to be there. Even if there are no crowds, you're still going to need, there's still going to be 250 people in a building.
And you, I think, multiply, we understand that right?
Okay, but again, by the time those things are available, by any logical timeline, it's going to be too close to the start of next season, in which case, I think the clock has already run out on this idea because the medicine isn't allowing that clock to start at all.
Do we know that from the testing perspective? Do we know because my understanding is that it's very possible that we could have a rapid, accurate test by June, for instance, or July.
I haven't heard that verified by anybody, and as of yesterday, Dr. Fauci didn't think that was likely to happen. Even the people who are working on a vaccine at Oxford, and they seem to be further along. That's the test. They seem to be further along than anybody, and the last I saw, they were urging caution about thinking that this is going to happen anytime soon. So
I thought that was the vaccine that Oxford was talking about.
Yeah, the vaccine. I'm wrapped around my own head, but still. Without an ability to not only just detect the disease but ameliorate it, you're still running into what I think Steve Kerr and others would say is too high a risk for even teams that are going to be involved in this. I mean, can the league, in search of a playoff system, risk LeBron James or Anthony Davis, or Giannis, or Luka, or anybody else getting the virus? They already have watched Rudy Gobert get it. They've already watched Kevin Durant get it. I mean, is this endurable? You know, and that's a question I don't know that there's an answer to, but I think right now the answer to that question is a not good one.
Every single indication in the world is it would be the wrong time to start. It'd be the wrong time to squeeze in something hastily. Patience is the only prescription that seems to fit the bill right now. And for these leagues to climb over each other in the name of we're running out of patience because we're running out of money, it seems untenable to me. It really has. And we've been on this talking point for weeks now, and there's no evidence to suggest that we might be off our rockers. The people that appear to be off their rockers are the people who are still in the bargaining stage of the five stages of grief, and we have several leagues in this country still very much bargaining the reality that they're in. Well, what could we do if and everything and rosy and you know, a rainbow kisses us on our forehead and everything is okay again? Okay, yeah, then have a plan. But until then, geesh, it's looking less and less realistic. A huge decision today by one of San Francisco's biggest industries might be an answer, more of an indicator than anything else. And it looks like the NHL is ready to admit the situation it's in. We'll come back with that. And then at 3:30 today, a conversation we've been looking forward to all week, Joe Staley, retired 49er tackle. He joins us today at 3:30, and we're looking forward to that. Damon Ratto and Kolsky, brought to you by Radio.com. Make sure you download the Radio.com app. Favorite the station, 95.7 The Game. Boom, take us anywhere you go. Damon Ratto and Kolsky here on 95.7 The Game.
Now back to Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
In 12 minutes, we say hello to Joe Staley. He's been one of the best conversations throughout his entire career. Now that he's retired, I doubt that has changed, but his life is about to change dramatically. One of the best to ever play, Joe Staley, is going to join us coming up from the 49ers today at 3:30. We're looking forward to that. Damon Ratto and Kolsky here on 95.7 The Game. Ray, this morning, when we were going over the things we wanted to talk about, you did bring up something that the NHL was basically about to admit or going to admit. It looks like the NHL is starting to think of next season starting possibly push back in December. So if they're talking about pushing the start of next season back to December, if that's the correct month, it feels like it would be really hard to expect them to wrap up this season and have a playoffs for this year. So what's going on there?
It suggests that they know that it's going to take a long time to restart this season in whatever form they choose to do it. The story was from Pierre LeBrun of The Athletic, who is as wired with management and owners as anybody in the sport. And if they're floating that at a time when baseball is floating 12 different plans to restart by the end of June, it's an indication that the optimism of about a week ago has now been tempered by the reality of not being able to pull this off. I mean, and it's more intricate in the NHL because it's very hard to go from the United States into Canada without a permanent worker visa. And that means that if you're, let's say, the Colorado Avalanche and you're playing Calgary in the first round of the playoffs, there's an excellent chance that some of your players won't be able to get in for one reason or another because Canada is being very restrictive about which people from America get to come in because of our shoddy work in detecting and controlling the virus. So I think they're starting to come around to the notion that there are way too many moving parts to make this work anytime soon. And by any time soon, I mean, you know, maybe the end of summer.
Right, this year.
Well, I mean, at some point, they probably would have to just cancel the whole season if that's what they're looking at. But the fact that they're already talking about pushing back the start of next season is an indication that they think there's going to be a lot more dead time before they could even think about getting started again. Because they've already rejected the bubble theory that the NBA keeps floating around and that MLB keeps playing with.
I don't know if there's any facility that would even allow hockey to come on in and have a bubble. Is there? I mean, who's got
right?
Like,
I mean, I don't think they have
right next to each other. It's harder
for hockey to find that. I think that's the key difference. If you're talking about how realistic these plans are between what hockey is talking about and what the NBA in particular, but even baseball are talking about with the actual bubbleness of their various bubble ideas varies, but they're all talking about some form of quarantine play, right? Hockey correct me if I'm wrong, Ray, but in terms of what Pierre LeBrun is saying, hockey is talking about next season in part because they don't want to start a new regular season without fans in the building, correct?
That might be part of it, but the logistics, I know somebody who's a high-ranking member of the Toronto Blue Jays and is married to a woman who works in New York, and he can get back and forth across the border with not much trouble because he has a permanent worker visa. she can't get into Canada because she doesn't have that, because she doesn't work in Canada. Now, multiply that by the number of people on an American-based hockey team. And so there's that. There's they want to play before people. They could go to Toronto and find enough rinks. That's not the problem. They don't. I mean, the real issue is that they can't guarantee that even teams that have qualified for the playoffs can get in. And then if they go in, whether they can get back out, let's say, and this is a bad example because none of the California teams are getting in this year, but let's say the Anaheim Ducks were a playoff team. They could get into Canada, you know, if they did all the rigmarole and paperwork. But once they got back out, they would have to go back into quarantine based on the shelter in place rules of the state, which means that once they go into Canada, they've got to stay there for the whole time. And then when they come back, they've got to be retested and re-quarantined.
So it's a 14-day layoff in between games 2 and 3.
Yeah, they would have to play all the games in one place if they were going to do the bubble idea. So I think what they're finding out is, because they floated the idea of playing up in North Dakota. But all that did was point out the fact that North Dakota doesn't have enough hotel space. And it's to do the playoffs in one place, you know, is you could solve that problem. But it's all the other stuff. And the fact that, you know, I think hockey and basketball, it would be hard to make that a great optic in an antiseptic setting. And I think there are some purists who are saying, I don't want to do that without that. And some of those purists own teams that are not in the playoffs at all.
Look, it's like the scene in The Princess Bride where he keeps on saying, inconceivable. And it's like, I don't think you're using that word right. Or to me, I think we are using that word right. It's inconceivable to me how you can pull this off. And it just feels like there has been more dignity in the admission that French soccer has made. You got all these American leagues just postponing the inevitable, postponing the obvious. If you stop looking at this through the prism of how can I recoup my losses? The minute you stop looking at this through the prism of how does the League X recoup its losses, and you ask what's the right thing to do, reaching the conclusion that we're all done playing sports for this foreseeable future is easy. It's only bargaining and holding on to the hope that you can somehow still salvage it. That is just, I don't know. I mean, how can baseball be talking about how optimistic it is returning publicly and leaking those stories through Jeff Passan and Ken Rosenthal and all the usual suspects, and then the very next day tell you, up Cooperstown, July 24th through 27th, that's canceled. We're not going to be doing that. No Hall of Fame class for Derek Jeter this year, but we're optimistic we're going to be able to get in a completely ridiculous 30-team, three-league redesign, universal DH, 15-minute games being played. I mean, like, I just, come on. You're talking out of both sides of your mouth. Joe Staley is going to be joining us here in just a moment. I want to remind everyone that.
I think there's, everything you just said is true, but there are a lot of variables that go into, and also I think a lot of reasonable differences in terms of what is the foreseeable future when you say we're not going to have any sports for the foreseeable future. I mean, I think any reasonable person can look around and say we're not going to have any sports in any time before the end of May, and in all likelihood, most if not all of June. I think that's where it starts getting a little hazier, and things are changing and have changed fast enough that, to me, it's not utterly inconceivable that the NBA, via some sort of bubble plan, could attempt to pick up their playoffs in mid-July. You know, I don't think it's 80% likelihood by any stretch of the imagination. I also don't think it's impossible. And while obviously I'm with you guys in terms of being cautious and being reasonable and doing the right and safe thing, I don't know that I'm prepared to rule out that there is a safe and perfectly viable way for, say, the NBA playoffs to happen before they start next season.
And look, if you can set it up in a way that gets everybody to agree to the parameters and it's not the Hunger Game and no one's being forced into a situation they'd rather not be in for their own personal health concerns, fine. But that's an awful lot of consensus and an awful lot of agreement with so many moving parts. Again, it just it feels like so much needs to happen with a massive medical sprint to a solution that normally takes a marathon to reach. I just do not know how. And again, some big news today is that the biggest tech company in San Francisco has canceled the biggest tech conference in the world and all in-person events globally through the end of the year. And this is the company that my wife works for, and she has a huge role to play in this and how they go about to repivoting what they do with their, you know, community and how they serve their community. But look, I'm going to tell you right now that Salesforce studies more about its customer data and feedback than these teams do. These teams,
no doubt,
and for them to have reached the conclusion that we can't do this because there isn't a customer base to serve in person anymore right now this year. Woo. That's there is some news there, whether you want to pretend there is or isn't.
It's huge, but in terms of its effect on sports, its effect on whether sports can happen, I think it speaks more to the sports as we remember it with crowds and in big arenas than it does to whether one of these bubble plans could work, right? Because if you're talking about Dreamforce, it's thousands and thousands of people gathering together in various spaces over the course of a week or whatever it is. So
100,000. So it's 100,000
exactly.
Plus.
So that, for them to say we are nowhere near large gatherings is responsible and correct, and I think tells you that even if hockey does start next season in December, it's not likely to be in front of fans.
I do know that when we start the next football season, the staple, the blindside tackle that the 49ers grew so used to will not be there. Joe Staley is joining us here on Damon Ratto and Kolsky. We are thrilled to have him on with us in the week that he announced his retirement. Joe, first of all, a career well played, every dollar well earned, a tip of the cap to you in the way you conducted business throughout the entirety of your career. I remember when you were drafted, and you were fantastic every day afterwards. Congratulations to you.
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's been kind of a whirlwind since that announcement on Saturday, so you know, a little bit overwhelming and everything, but it's been really nice to hear and a lot of people that have, you know, I've had a chance to work with over the years, and it's been a cool 4 or 5 days.
It's got to be amazing to kind of hear your own eulogy, right? Like all these people are talking about the guy who was such a great captain, such a great leader. It's got to be humbling to hear it, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was telling my wife, Carrie, I was like, you know, it's almost overwhelming to hear everything, and because I think people and human nature too, you don't really get an opportunity to kind of share, you know, your feelings about someone and how much you appreciate them and, you know, whatever. And, you know, maybe you're not even aware, you know, kind of impact that you're having on people. And then for all that to kind of just come out and be told to you in one weekend was a little bit overwhelming, and, you know, for sure, appreciated a ton. You know, I felt very loved. But it was a bittersweet because obviously, like what I said in my statement, you know, it was a really hard decision. You know, I still love the game of football a ton and wasn't really expecting this to go down. And but it was a decision I had to make and had to come to.
Rehashing this as many times as you have in the last 4 days, has that made the start of your transition better or worse? Because there's always the part that you're going to miss, and having to talk about it over and over again could either be therapeutic or it could be kind of a drag.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that question because I don't know if I haven't really have thought about that. But now that you mention it, you know, I think it has been a little bit therapeutic because, you know, I think it's been, like I said, it was a hard decision. but it was the right decision for what I needed to do with my life and, you know, my future and stuff. And, you know, just realizing that, you know, I left my mark a little bit in the, you know, the game of football and everything that I've, you know, poured my whole entire, you know, every moment of my life for the last, you know, 15, 16 years going back to college. You know, I felt like I accomplished something and definitely some impacted some players and, you know, coaches and in a positive manner. So, you know, I definitely hold my head high, and I think it's been really cool to kind of, you know, reconnect with a lot of players and people that I've come in, you know, in contact with throughout the years and worked with, and, you know, talk about old memories, and it's fun going down that road. So I think it's been good. It's helped the transition a little bit. But I think the thing that would be really hard, you know, this I'm kind of anticipating, is like once it gets down to, because really, I mean, since I was, probably 9 years old, you know, it's just you get to that August, September time, and it's time to play football, and it's just what I've known. And so, you know, it'll be really a change to be on the opposite side and just be watching as a fan and not having to prepare myself for the upcoming season.
You talked about affecting other players, and I think anyone who tracked the sort of video call you guys did yesterday saw that on the faces of some of those players, McGlinchey and Kittle, and I know Justin Smith called you the perfect leader. And I'm curious whether that comes from a specific leadership philosophy. Do you feel like that's just, it was just naturally who you were, or is that something you specifically developed and tried to be a mentor to other players?
Yeah, early on, I mean, I definitely did not, I never looked at myself as a leader. You know, it wasn't a role that I really even welcomed, because I was always looked at a leader as someone that was, you know, given the speeches and, you know, you kind of have an idea coming, you know, out of college, especially, is that, you know, the leader of the team is the guy that gives speeches, he does the rah-rah stuff. And that was just never me. I was never a guy that was going to get up in front of the team and talk about what we needed to do. But what I could do and I could control was just the way that I worked and the way that I approached every day, meeting room and the weight room, and, you know, just the effort that you give to what we're doing. And so I think I just kind of developed maybe that style of leadership was kind of like my own, of just being the guy that would work. And I would kind of show you, you know, not out of any kind of purpose of like I'm trying to show you something, but, you know, people would watch and they would see, you know, this guy's been in the league for a while, you know, let's see what he does. And I was always really cognizant of like people are watching what I'm doing, so I want to make sure that I'm giving the right example of what I think a football player should be and how you want to conduct yourself. And then I think as I got older, I definitely became more comfortable and more aware even that, you know, I am a veteran, I am a leader on this football team, and I start, you know, projecting my voice and my opinions a little bit louder. And I think I could became more comfortable with doing that as I, you know, got more established. But it was all just really about work, you know, and I think that can go into a lot of different areas of your life. It's just the effort and the work that you put into what you're doing and making it, you know, the most important task that you're doing in that moment.
Well, I tell you, you should go into being a football analyst, Joe. They're giving those guys like $15 million a year. Now, I don't know if you needed to be a Dallas Cowboy quarterback in order to get that deal, but you, I always thought you had a great broadcasting future in your future, if that's indeed what you wanted. If you'd ever like to co-host a radio show, you're welcome in any point in time with us. It's always good to talk to you. You know, when we talked to you last year, you mentioned that retirement really wasn't on your horizon, and then obviously you went through a rough year physically. It was my summation, though, Joe, that COVID-19 and just the odd timeline and the circumstances that we're all facing factored into your decision. Was I right or wrong?
No, that actually wasn't. It was just, you know, the kind of the timing, I guess, but it wasn't at all as far as like an, you know, made me think more about it. It really was just about my body. And, you know, this last year, you know, obviously I had the, you know, leg and the finger and stuff that I missed games for. But it was much more just, you know, my neck, back, mm-hmm. you know, things that I was just kind of dealing with over the years. just getting really progressively worse and worse, and then kind of came to a head basically at the end of the season and throughout the playoffs, and then really at a head kind of the Super Bowl. And it was just, so I knew after that I was going to have to do some, you know, talking with doctors and kind of figuring out what's going on. And then after talking with all them, you know, I don't want to get into everything, but, you know, realize how serious it was. And, you know, that I'll have to, you know, probably really contemplate this. And so it was kind of all that more than any of the stuff that's going on right now.
How many defensive opponents whose ass you kicked over the course of your career have called to send congratulations and or why didn't you retire before this?
you know, I had a lot of people reach out. You know, I didn't have it was really kind of overwhelming. I got to the point where when it first broke, I was you know, trying my best to, like, you know, respond to everybody's calls and texts. And then it got to be a, you know, everything was kind of flooding, and I just put my phone down and I opened up a bottle of bourbon and I just sat out there on the lawn and kind of enjoyed being outside and watching the kids run around and just kind of was out in the sun. We had a nice sunny day down here in San Diego, so I just kind of hung out there. And then I went actually through my phone yesterday and started kind of responding to a lot of people that have reached out, and, you know, that I have some time to kind of go through everything. And it was, like I said, it was really overwhelming kind of just to hear everybody's stories and talk with a lot of different people.
So I'm going to try to sneak in a double question along those lines. Of all the guys you went up against, all your assignments over the years, does someone stand out as the toughest guy to block? And then when you sort of look back at your career, which I imagine you've done a lot over the last couple of days, is there one moment that stands out?
Yeah, toughest guy to block. I mean, for me, throughout my career, there's this, and DeMarcus Ware was always a challenge going up against him in a game situation. I always never felt like I came out of the game with any kind of, you know, positive thoughts about my play. He was just a really hard player to play against, prepare for. So unique, and everything that he did was like power and speed and the length and the technique that he used. I mean, he was just unbelievable. And then, you know, I'll always remember going against Michael Strahan just because, you know, he was a guy that I watched from my youth, and then getting a chance my rookie year going against him and taught me a ton because I got my, you know, my butt kicked in that game. And then, you know, taught me a ton about how to prepare and not get psyched out for an opponent. And, you know, it really helped me a ton going forward in my career. But then I think the guys that were just the hardest were, you know, the two guys that I played, you know, in the middle of my career and then the end of my career. The Niners, just going against every day. You know, the Smith brothers, Alden and Justin, during those Harbaugh years, it was just unbelievable getting to practice against them. I mean, they made me an immensely better football player just because you had to be on it all the time or you're going to get exposed in practice. And then Nick last year, just in that one training camp I had with him, and just realized how special he was and how talented of a football player he's going to be.
Joe Staley, here on 95.7 The Game, and in our last moment with you here for now, Joe, I said that the great player can be seen at the end of his career when he makes one more play, and your last play is throwing one more block for your quarterback by letting the Niners know your retirement plans before the draft. It allowed them the room to trade for Trent Williams. What do you think of that move and the player that will be protecting Jimmy Garoppolo in the same way that you did?
Yeah, I couldn't be more ecstatic to have Trent with the Niners. You know, I've long really respected his game. He's an absolutely tremendous left tackle. And it was really important to me to, you know, I was kind of, when I was going through the process, I kind of set a date of obviously before the draft. You know, I was in contact with the Niners during this whole process and kind of letting them know where I was at. And then I wanted to have the decision done and final before the draft so they could, you know, really prepare for whatever they wanted to do going forward. And then for them to be able to, you know, land a guy of, you know, Trent's caliber, is just, you know, makes me, you know, really excited because, you know, it's the best decision for my family. And then also that I'm not really, screwing over the Niners. you know, they're going to be just fine. And you know, I think you're going to fit really well in what they do. Obviously, you're very familiar with Kyle and their offense, having to play with him in Washington. And then he'll be a great fit in that room as well.
I got to tell you, Joe, you've been a pleasure to cover. You've been a pleasure to talk to. You've been a pleasure to watch play. One of the best this team's ever had, one of the best Niners I've ever had the pleasure of covering. Thank you so much for joining us. Really, really appreciate it today. Best of luck with the future and everything going forward. And we hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yeah, for sure. I'm not going to be a stranger at all. And I really appreciate, you know, our conversations that we've had throughout the year. It's been really fun. I mean, I look back on all the time with the Niners with really great memories, and it was a lot because of you know, the people I got to meet and people I got to talk to, and it's just a childhood dream come true, man. And I'll miss it for sure. So thanks again for having me on and let me talk to you guys a little bit today, and wish you guys nothing but the best.
Same to you, Joe. Tip of the cap. Awesome. Awesome stuff. Joe Staley, brought to you by Fremont Bank, still open to serve the community that they love with full service banking and no compromises.
Now back to Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Good to catch up with Joe Staley as he rides off into the sunset. We still got you here until 6 o'clock tonight. Damon, Ratto, and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game. Mina Kimes is going to be joining us in less than 45 minutes from right now. One of the most downloaded voices in America. You can't spell ESPN without M-I-N-A. She is all over. We got a ton to talk to her about. Guys, if you were on Twitter today, if you're on social media, if you're reading articles on sports websites, you're seeing the acronym N-I-L everywhere. N-I-L. I mean, nil to me meant, oh, we're talking soccer. Somebody's got a zero. It's a nil. I know what that is. It's World Cup. It's say nil nil. It's so much more European than saying zero. But that's not what it means. It's name, image, likeness. And this is a big story in sports in terms of the NCAA's illusion of amateurism being chipped away at one more time by a reasonable decision that these kids are now going to be able to profit on their own names, images, and likenesses when we do have kind of normal sports once again. And this is going to be a massive change. We've seen the NCAA be confronted almost at gunpoint, at knife point, to confront massive change, either through what is happening in the G League with elite players now turning their attention there, and now this.
It's fascinating because the more you think about it, the more that what this ruling actually does, other than deal slightly less unfairly with some athletes, it's that it puts schools that don't have a big sort of commercial presence where they are or are in a smaller town at a disadvantage because they won't be able to get the guy that they want to get if part of the recruiting sale is we also have you lined up with three car dealers. And I think while it's not a good enough reason not to have done this, I believe that it's part of the reason why the NCAA was leery about going down this road. One, they didn't want to have to sit there and get in bidding wars with alums and you know local sponsors, but it also further separates the elite money-making schools from everybody else. And the NCAA has always had a tough time keeping the big money school in line. And this might help big schools to form their own association and just leave the NCAA behind. Because really, the only thing the NCAA really does is handle the money and pass it out. They don't really do anything of material value to a place like Texas or Alabama or North Carolina, places like that. And I think it's one of the reasons why the NCAA resisted this for as long as it did, other than the fact that it didn't want to get involved with that and they wanted to keep the athletes nice and poor, is that it undermines some of their support because the people who are most involved in the NCAA tend to be mid to low level schools because they're the ones who benefit from the NCAA and the way it distributes money more than big schools do.
All that makes sense to me, but how much different really is allowing players to profit off name and likeness than what those big money schools are already able to give those players in straight cash, homie? Like, I'm not sure it changes the recruiting dynamic that much. Yes, those big schools still have an advantage, but it may very well pay to be the big fish in a small pond, literally now pay, to be, say, a stud quarterback at, for lack of a better example, Richmond, than to be the third quarterback at Bama or what have you. Like, there are ways that this will work itself out in the same way that schools that didn't have a bag of cash to offer occasionally are able to recruit good players.
Nothing made Mac football more competitive than scholarship limits on bigger campuses. And opportunity to play was, you know, pulled from stacked rosters. And so if you really wanted to play, you had to go to another school. And that really breathed life into an awful lot of schools. This could have some positive effects. The big man, big fish in a small pond. Yeah, there's definitely some elements to that. To me, what I don't understand is why anybody in the NCAA would complain about this one bit. All it does is tarnish your already hard to see Norman Rockwell illusion of amateurism, and you still don't pay a kid a dime. It doesn't affect your bottom line at all. The NCAA is still enjoying a universe where someone else other than they pays the student athlete. It might be the local Buick dealership or the bar or the restaurant, but it's still no skin off the NCAA's back. As long as they get to keep every nickel coming to them, what's the complaint? I mean, there shouldn't be one.
The complaint is it comes when you realize that the NC2A is not just a bunch of guys who work in Indianapolis. It's all the people at those mid-level and low-level schools who wanted to hold the line every chance they got because they don't want to get into a situation where profit and loss becomes that much more unequal in their minds. I think you raise a good point, Matt, in that this doesn't really aggressively affect that, but it was the idea that once you give them something, they'll ask for something else, and that all of a sudden the stipend will become a regular check. And so it was really just about, you know, holding the line and continuing to hold the line. And as long as they could get away with holding the line, that's money that they wouldn't have to spend. And now they're in this situation. And I'm sure the next thing that's going to happen is someone's going to sue, basically saying, I'm unpaid labor. Why am I not protected by, by the rights of workers as opposed to being a student? You know, it's the fear of the unknown that drives most people into doing unreasonable things. And even after you explain what the known can be, they will always sort of default to, well, what happens after that? And I think that was the real driving force behind this, you know, behind fighting this, just like it was stipends, just like it was, you know, forever and ever and ever. They were willing to look the other way on big schools paying guys under the table as long as they could walk around and say, well, we don't pay athletes. Well, now they're allowing athletes to be paid by others who almost in all cases, you know, have connections to the school. And people will say, well, you know, how is that different? And it's not really that different in their minds. So they approved of this only because it was legally indefensible, not because they think it's a way to keep players happy.
Right. State Senator, California State Senator Nancy Skinner from Berkeley said today, after California and states across the country put the ball in their court, the NCAA has taken a step in the right direction. College athletes are on their way to making money off their name, image, and likeness, just like all other Americans can. The devil will be in the details, no matter how you cut it. This represents a landmark college change. A year ago, no one would have expected the NCAA to move so definitively towards giving college athletes their nil name, image, and likeness rights. California launched a tidal wave with more than two dozen states joining the cause to give student athletes their nil rights. I urge states to press forward with their plans to keep the pressure on the NCAA. I also look forward to closely examining the NCAA's decision and monitoring the steps it will take going forward. Pressure from states and public will help ensure the NCAA does the right thing and crosses the finish line to fully give college athletes the same rights that all other Americans enjoy. And she is right. The devil will be in the details and controlling the unintended consequences, which I heard someone bring up like, hey, don't we need to make sure that, you know, no quarterback at Ohio State makes more money than a quarterback in another conference at a premier school? Well, now you have a capped sport if that's what we're doing. And is that what we're doing? Yeah.
No, we don't have to do that.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think this can be as simple as it sounds or as complicated as they want to make it.
Right.
But in my mind, there's no reason to complicate it. It just thinking about – so two things about those comments from the state senator. First of all, it's a little bit of a humble brag, right? It's like, you're welcome, America.
Yeah. No, California she dunked on everyone. This. She dunked.
And she's not wrong. California did do this. You know, Gavin Newsom maybe more than anyone, crazily enough. Like – they put pressure on the NCAA, and this happened very quickly in response. So it is a credit to California. Exactly. Good job, California, once again. The second.